My name is Graham Nichols.
And I'm Isaac Bannister, and you're listening to Ordinary. Welcome back, everyone. I'm stepping in for Josh again this week, and I'm joined by Graham, as you can see. And it's one of those exciting weeks. We've got a special guest with us. Hello, Glenn. How are you doing?
I'm doing really well. Thank you, Isaac. Thanks for having me on.
No, thanks for joining us. For those who don't know who you are, could you give us a quick roundup of who you are, where you're from, that kind of thing?
Great. I am Glenn. I'm Emma's husband. I'm Ruby and JJ's dad. I live in Eastbourne on the south coast of England. I'm from Australia originally, but I've lived half my life in the UK. I'm an ordained minister in the Church of England, but my day job is as an evangelist to go around and help churches to be good news advocates out in the world.
Awesome. Amazing. Thank you. And what about Speak Life? Could you tell us a little bit about Speak Life, what you do with Speak Life?
Great. It's been a ministry that's been going for 70 years now, and it was founded by a big kind of crusades evangelist called Eric Hutchings, who back in the day did the big mass interdenominational Billy Graham type thing, and he had a radio program. And so he founded a ministry called The Hour of Revival, which was also the name of his radio show, and so he would preach the gospel live and also have a media component. And if you went to Liverpool when he was doing his mission, there would be big buses and it would say, "Millions hear him, now come and see him." And he would, you know, preach. And, you know, Cliff Richard would come and give his testimony and the choir would sing and people would come forward and give their lives to Jesus. It was that kind of a thing. And so the constitution of the Hour of Revival, Evangelistic Association was the full name, was very much we're into preaching and media. And he died in 1982, but they were advertising for the second evangelist to ever work for the Evangelistic Association in 2010. I joined in 2010, and I was, the second evangelist. There was kind of a 30-year gap between the first and the second evangelist. But it's been amazing how I've been able to kind of slot in and do pretty much the same two things, which is preaching the gospel and doing the media thing. And the media thing has changed a little bit with social media and video stuff. But essentially, I'm trying to do the same thing, get the good news out via face-to-face proclamation and through media. And we've got 6 interns with us, and you can come and train with us for 10 months if you want to come down to Eastbourne, the Sunshine Coast, and we learn together, we go on mission together, we produce resources together. So we produce films, we're on YouTube and Facebook and Twitter and TikTok and wherever it is that people need to hear about Jesus, which is everywhere. And we just try to make a noise for Jesus any way we can.
Awesome. Okay, amazing.
I did not know that history, the 70-year history. So that was really helpful. I do know Glenn, but I didn't know all that. So, that's really useful. It's quite interesting that those people in sort of times past who in their day kind of realised the value of media and kind of started things off. It's quite fascinating, some of the stuff that Billy Graham did, which was really innovative at the time, but we kind of think it's all a bit sort of clunky now and a bit weird. But a lot of the stuff was really, really innovative.
It was pioneering. I mean, he was into pirate radio, Eric Hutchings, and so he would literally, push the boats out, beyond the borders and beam gospel messages back into the UK, and so it was right on the cutting edge, and we are nowhere near as innovative in our day, I think, as Eric Hutchings was in his. So I think it's a real challenge for us.
Exciting. Okay. And you're an author as well, right? And you've got a new book coming out called The Air We Breathe, How We All Came to Believe in Freedom, Kindness, Progress, Inequality. Could you outline what the main thing about in this book is going to be?
It's basically about the fact that we are all far more Christian than we imagine ourselves to be. Even if you've never been to church, even if you've never clapped eyes on a Bible, you have been shaped by the Jesus Revolution at the most profound level. And one of the ways you know you've been shaped by it is that you don't know that you've been shaped by it. It's like the air that we breathe. It's like goldfish not knowing that they're swimming in water. They say, "What's water?" It's the very atmosphere of our lives. And yet, we tend to think that Christianity is this other thing off to one side. And what I try to do in the core of the book is go through 7 values that Christianity has taught the world that are now second nature to us. And those values are equality, compassion, consent, enlightenment, science, freedom, and progress. And as I teach through those seven values, I actually take the reader from Genesis right through to George Floyd. So in Genesis, we're talking about equality and the image of God. In compassion, we're talking about the coming of Christ and the way that the cross has upended all our notions. And then when I talk about consent, I'm talking about the sort of the sexual revolution that has really shaped this world, not the 1960s, but the sort of the AD 60s, go back to the early church. And then I talk about enlightenment, which often we think of the years between the fall of Rome and the Renaissance as the Dark Ages. But actually, I want to talk about there was a heck of a lot more light going on in those years than we usually imagine. And then science, the scientific revolution, again, coming out of Christian values and Christian scientists. And freedom, we talk about emancipation and the abolition of the slave trade. And then progress. Why do we get the idea that tomorrow is meant to be better than today, and today we're meant to be reforming some of the evils that were back in the past? Again, that's a really profoundly Christian idea. And you add all those things together, and you've pretty much got the modern Western outlook. But all of those things are totally bonkers without Jesus. So yeah. It seems like we have a Western society that wants the fruits of Christianity, but not the roots. And it's really a call to Christians to recognize, you know what? Our ancient faith explains the modern world and explains it better than any secular thinker you can name. But also to those who think of themselves as secular and think of themselves as non-Christian and as not being believers, I want to point to them and say, you know what? You believe a whole heap of supernatural things. Like, if you think that human beings are equal, and if you think that a society should be judged according to how we treat the weakest and the least among us, if you believe in human rights and human equality and humanism and all these different things, you're already believing things that are not natural. They are not basic. They are not universal. Other societies have not thought this way at all. And the only reason we think these things is Jesus. And so it's a challenge to them to actually ground what they already believe in the Jesus story.
Yeah, sounds a really interesting book. So I'm interested to buy it already. I actually want to buy it now, even as we're speaking. It reminded me of we had Dan Strange on a week or so ago on Ordinary, and I was at a lecture of his, kind of lunchtime lecture yesterday, and it was just something he said in passing. I asked a question about Christians who've been involved in the slave trade and various other things and kind of how we answer that. And he made the really simple point, which was easy to remember, which is, It's only Christianity that gives you the tools to critique Christianity.
Yes.
So it's Christianity that gives you the categories in order to look at Jonathan Edwards and his slaves and think, that wasn't quite right. It's Christianity that gives you those tools to critique itself, as it were, to critique how it's working out. But it's a really good thing to say. I do a little bit of radio work, as you know, and I was on with James Whale and Ash on Talk Radio, and I was trying to make these points, but people do think morality comes out of the air. They genuinely thought it just is. You know, he said, well, it's obvious that it's wrong to kill people. You know, and they genuinely thought I was being ridiculous, suggesting that it can't just arrive by sort of spaceship. You know, it has to have some sort of basis. Interesting though.
Yeah, and that's why I call it the air we breathe, because there's this sense that all these values that are particularly Christian, and obviously other cultures do the thou shalt not kill thing, but the idea that you should particularly prize the weak, what Nietzsche called the weak, the low, and the botched. Nietzsche said, you know, it is a law of survival that the weak, the low, and the botched shall not survive, and we shall help them in this. Right? Like, we shall give nature a helping hand because nature is always winnowing the weak. So it is a pro-life outlook, says Nietzsche, to help nature in crushing the weak and eliminating the disabled and all those sorts of things. And actually, it's difficult to argue against Nietzsche unless you want to stand on Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
And he names it. He says the poison of pity was injected into Western civilization in the first century, and we're still suffering its ill effects. The poison of pity. So, like, the idea that you sacrifice the weakest for the survival of the fittest, That's written into our biology. That is the way of the flesh, to use a more biblical phrase about it. But what does Jesus do? He reverses the way of the flesh, and he, the fittest, is sacrificed so that we, the weakest, might survive. And then by the Spirit, he births a movement that is the opposite of how every other culture functions and how the biological world functions. Everyone else is survival of the fittest and the sacrifice of the weakest. And Christianity births a movement that is the sacrifice of the strongest in order to have the survival of the weakest. None of that is obvious. All of that is nuts. And we take it for granted. It's the air that we breathe. And so my big thing is, you don't need to take a leap of faith if you believe in something like compassion or equality. You don't need to take a leap of faith. You are already midair. You're already 30,000 feet in the air. You need some ground beneath your feet. And the only foundation that actually works for the things that you actually believe is Jesus Christ. So that's the shape of the book.
Yeah, it's fascinating. And I always think this, like you've really already mentioned, it relates so much to progressive culture today, when people are standing up for the people who have had the least rights and people who are marginalized in society. Unknowingly, they're holding up this morality, which is really founded in the first century, like you said. I don't think they know they're doing that, but if they were really being secular about it, they wouldn't be saying these people really matter, the marginalized. They would be saying, well, they're weak, so they're weak, if you see what I mean.
Sociologists talk about competitive victimhood these days, and like everyone is trying to be the first to get their claim to victimhood in, because we want to be marginalized, because there's a cachet in being marginalized. Why should there be any cachet in being marginalized at all? We've been so shaped by the Jesus story, which has at its center a loser who wins. You know, he's the victim who ends up being the victor. And that's the most nuts story that the world has ever told. But the fact that we now take it for granted, that we now want to rush to claim victim status, that's not an obvious thing that anyone should do. It's only because we've been discipled by the Jesus revolution, whether or not we've stepped inside church or not. So everyone is dealing with these Christian sensibilities, and the culture wars are basically, we're hurling Bible verses at each other. We've just forgotten the references, you know, and we anathematize people, right? And we excommunicate people. That's another way of saying we cancel people. Like, why do you cancel people? Well, because we're still incurably religious. We've just slightly tweaked the creeds, but we're still going to excommunicate those who don't, you know, sign up to our statements of faith. So I don't think you can understand our modern moment without being very versed in Christianity and the ways in which, stepping beyond the Christian story, we're kind of like Wile E. Coyote, kind of going over the cliff, and he's dangling there for a little moment, but he can't dangle there for long. You know, there will be a crash.
So then something is obviously changing. We've got here over 2,000 years of following what Jesus put in motion right at the beginning, and now we're in a situation where that's our heritage. It's what we believe without even knowing we believe it. But like you said, the bottom's fallen out. So where does it leave us? What does that mean for a morality and culture going forward?
I think we need some ground beneath our feet. We want the fruits, but without the root of Jesus. We want the kingdom, but we don't want the king. And I think more and more we're seeing that no dice. You simply cannot have the fruit without the root. You cannot have the kingdom without the king.
It's a bit like pressed flowers, isn't it? Not pressed flowers, bunches of flowers.
Right.
Where if you take the roots away, you can transplant them into a vase and they will survive for a while, but they won't survive for long, because what makes them flourish is no longer there. So I don't know what that means. You may know, Glenn. I don't know what that means in terms of whether society will sort of collapse like, you know, the Roman Empire, with a sort of long, slow cultural influence and military might death to be replaced by something more barbaric. I don't know what that means in how it works out, but certainly there's not the life flow to make life flourish.
No, exactly. I think it must be different from the Roman fall,
Yeah.
Largely because we have been so Christianized. So the ways in which we fall will be in post-Christian ways rather than in pre-Christian ways. Yes. And technology will play... It will look very different, because I think we could have a society that collapses, but we still have our iPhone 37, you know, and there'll be massive, you know, differentials between the rich and the poor, but the rich will still live comfortably. And so what societal collapse will look like will be very different. And I think the ways in which we go post-Christian will be incredibly moralistic, and I think we're seeing that, because if for instance, we cling on to seven values, but we don't actually have the Christ from whom those values are given, we're going to be the most moralistic people in the world. We think we're over church, and yet we become like church ladies with the wagging finger. And so there'll be lots of ways in which I think our post-Christian drift will look different. So for instance, Dostoevsky, you know, says, you know, without God, everything is permitted. Whereas I think without God, everything is really preachy, like incredibly preachy. And this is one of the outcomes of the fact that the fall of this empire will be the fall of a Christianized empire, unless we come back to the foundation, unless we come back to Jesus. And you know, one of the things I say in the book is that the tide of the Christian church comes in and out all the time. And I was really encouraged reading through lots of different histories of the Christian church. There was one chapter, I think, of one book that almost encouraged me more than any other for our own moment. And that was in Rodney Stark's book, The Triumph of Christianity, where he talks about how the age of faith that we imagine in medieval Christendom, we just imagine everyone went to church like in medieval Christendom, and that's how Christianized it was. And he just goes through the records and just shows it was just pandemonium. Like every now and again, the priest would go around and try and drum up people to get them into church, and then would immediately regret it because there was a fight breaking out and the dogs were yapping at each other and mum was dropping the baby in the front pew and like nobody could listen. The priest himself didn't like understand a single word that he was saying, didn't know where the Lord's Prayer was from or the fact that Jesus said it. And actually, when you look through history, we tend to think that everything was fine until the 1950s. And then the 60s hit, and that's been the trouble since then. And actually, there have been some much darker days in the last 2,000 years. And as G.K. Chesterton said, you know, Christianity had gone to the dogs at least six times in its history. And it ended up that it was the dog that died. Yeah. And he says, Christianity has died and risen again because we know someone who knows the way out of the grave. So that gives me hope that, you know, however dark we think our spiritual period is right now, we've been in worse situations before, and the Lord knows how to revive his church.
Yeah, amazing. Okay. So does that change then the way that we do evangelism? Evangelism is your thing, right? So this is why we're coming to you as the expert. We want to know.
Oh, man.
How do we change the way we're doing this so that we're applying to a culture that's in this state? People are deeply Christian, but the bottom's fallen out, like you said. Does that change the way we do it, or is it just still tell people about Jesus? That's as simple as it gets, and that's what we have to do. I suppose there's going to be nuance in the different ways that we do it. Like you're doing it through media, you're doing it through social media and stuff like that. And that's your focus, and that's a massive thing right now. But I wonder how, as things change, how do we change the way we evangelize? Do we need to change the way we evangelize?
I mean, preaching the gospel has been good enough for 2,000 years, and so you know, that's got to be what we do. And actually, when you look back at 2,000 years of history, one of the things that has encouraged me has been to see how distinctive the church has been, and how change and renewal has happened when the church has been different. Because you might think, okay, well, if the modern world has been so Christianized, maybe we just need to be like the world. No. The very opposite. It is precisely when the church has been very weird and very countercultural that it has had its biggest kind of impact. And so, you know, the ways that the church stood against the gladiatorial games or the exposure of infants, you know, back in the early centuries, or the ways in which evangelicals and Quakers stood against the slave trade, especially in the 18th and 19th centuries. It was when the church was very distinctive and different and calling people to the weirdness of the Jesus Revolution. That's actually so as I speak about these things, I'm not saying, hey, the church is just like the world and the world is just like the church, and that will help you in your evangelism. Actually, I'm saying the real impetus and power for the Jesus Revolution has always been when we're different. And so I would pick up on what Dan Strange often talks about, which is the subversive fulfillment of people's greatest desires. So if they talk about the value of the victim, let's say, the weak and the marginalized should be shown special honor. Okay, that's absolutely brilliant. I affirm that because it's the way of Jesus, but here I need to subversively fulfill your desire for the weak and the marginalized to be lifted up. Because first of all, you're an oppressor, right? You might want to cast yourself as a victim of circumstance, a victim of society, a victim of your genes, a victim of all sorts of other things. But there's plenty in my life, and there'll be plenty in your life, that convicts you of actually being an oppressor, of treading on the little guy, of betraying the value that you claim to hold. The good news for you is that Jesus suffered as the victim on your behalf, and suffered for the sins that you have committed, and rose up again, and calls you to a very different way of not rushing to be the victim, but actually being raised up by Jesus on your feet so that you can now, with him, protect victims and that sort of thing. So one way I would think about how this might help you in evangelism is point people to Dan Strange's kind of subversive fulfillment, and there's a weirdness to what we're called to when we do all that. I think another thing I would do is just don't believe your friend when they say that they're not a believer. They are a believer. And, you know, I had a friend who wrote me a letter and said, Glenn, as of course you must know, I could never be a believer like you. And yet this friend went on to talk about some incredibly sacrificial decisions that she and her husband were making in their family life. Decisions that don't make sense from a purely biological point of view. And what's been interesting in my continued conversation with her is that she kind of is a believer, right? There's something supernatural in her beliefs, because the way of nature is red in tooth and claw, but the way she wants to live is way above nature. It is supernatural. And I have found it really helpful to people to say to people, look, you do not need to take a leap of faith. You're already living according to all these sorts of beliefs that you can't prove. You can't prove that all people are equal. You can't prove that we should serve the poor. You can't prove any of these things. Show me the scientific experiment that yields this. Show me the logical arguments that leads to that conclusion. You are living not based on evidence, not based on science. You're living on faith. And you're betting your life on a certain view of the world, which cannot be proved. So don't give me that nonsense about you couldn't believe in the supernatural, you could never be a believer. You already are. But I want to give you grounds for living that kind of way. Can I tell you the Jesus story again? But those are some of the first moves that I'd make.
Yeah, I mean, it's really compelling. And just listening to you, I can imagine the conversation going really well. I guess most of our listeners, and me myself sometimes, it's in the actual real conversation that it's much harder, and it's much swifter. You don't get the time to think, you've just made a truth claim, or you've just made a faith statement, or you've just illustrated that you have a morality. I've now got to weigh in, because normally it's like bang, 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 and you know, you're at the school gates, or a meal with somebody, and you're out with your mates doing something else, and just something appears. And I don't know, I suppose it's partly training your thinking beforehand. So you just might, it's a bit like, you know, learning how to catch a ball or to hit something or whatever. You practice over and over again. And then in the fire of, you know, a real professional game in front of 30,000 people, you hit some balls. You might miss quite a lot.
And you miss quite a lot. Yeah, you always do. Yeah.
Yeah, but if you practice, you might hit some. So I don't know. I don't know what you think, really, because we had it with a video we were watching recently of Rico Tyson, one of our community groups in this show. And, you know, somebody said, well, I can never do it like him. You know, it's all right for him. You know, he does it as his day job. And, you know, he can think of all these clever things to say. And I was trying to encourage them to say, you know loads about Jesus. You know, compared to how much your friend knows about Jesus, you know lots and lots. And you have lots of worldview stuff and ideas of morality and origins. You know much more than you think. You know, this guy happened to be a gardener. And I said, even though you're a gardener and don't have a degree education, you know loads of stuff. But it is giving people the confidence that they do, and that they might not be able to wire it up like you just did in a kind of beautiful string of logical sort of statements. But they can say lots of good stuff. Is that true?
Yeah, I think that's totally true. And I mean, the things I get people to think about in terms of their personal evangelism, in particular, three questions. And I think I've mentioned these before on Ordinary, that you know, that's what I love about Jesus, dot, dot, dot. That's what I love about my church, dot, dot, dot. And I couldn't have gotten through X without Jesus. Yeah. And I always get people to sort of work on those statements, because that's kind of where they live their lives. But also, just on these sorts of topics, I was just in conversation this morning with a school friend who we were on the beach a couple of weeks ago, and he was thinking about adoption. And we're adoptive parents, and we were talking about the journey that you go through. And because I've spoken about our journey quite a lot, you get used to, you know, using words and you get used to framing it in terms of your faith. And I just couldn't frame what I have lived without my faith. And so hopefully it comes across as something that's organic. And so you say things like, you've got to really believe that unconditional love is how people thrive and change and flourish in life. You've got to really believe that. And he was like, no, I think I do believe that. I said, yeah, but it will be really tested because you'll give out and instead you might not get the warm response that you're looking for. And sometimes it feels excruciating to love in those ways. And so you are getting a lot of anger back, and you're trying to give a lot of grace that way. But somehow in that transaction, you meet their anger with your love. And somewhere there's a beautiful moment of their humbling and their acceptance of love and grace and a transformation. And what's fascinating is we had exactly that conversation. And the night before, he had emailed me, and he finished the email in caps lock. He said, "Do not try to convert me to Christianity." And yet the next morning, we're just talking about life, and we cannot talk about life without talking about, you know what, unconditional love, where you meet the anger of another with forgiving love. That's the most transformative experience that a human being can ever know. Wouldn't you agree? Of course he agreed with that. Mm-hmm. And I was cheeky enough at that stage to say, well, in one sense, I've just told you the Jesus story again, because that is how Jesus has met us, right? There's a lot of anger coming that way. He offers grace instead, and for me, nothing has changed me more than understanding grace in that sense. And I was cheeky enough to get away with it on that occasion, but I think I got away with it because it was earthed in my life.
It's a really good illustration, because I think it shows it's not really about practicing, as in a sort of wooden way, kind of practicing. Well, if someone says this, what do you say? But it is about thinking about some key things in your life in a spiritual way, and not compartmentalizing them into, you know, this is my family life and this is my work life. And by thinking about them spiritually, you've already got all the categories and vocabulary, like you were saying, to be able to talk about Jesus in the context of all those different things. Something that's really instructive. Did you have a COVID question, Isaac? Because I know when we're sort of nearly we're on a rundown now for the last few minutes.
I did. I can try and tie COVID in, although I feel like everyone's sick of talking about it. So everyone I don't feel that guilty. Yeah.
It's a post COVID question though.
Yeah. So just before that, one of the really interesting things I think you said, Glenn, was how the church is different, and when the church is different to culture, it has a certain attraction for people. People are attracted to it, and there's a conversation online between Douglas Murray and N.T. Wright on the Unbelievable channel, which is really, really fascinating because Douglas is not a Christian, but one of the things he says he hates about the church is the fact that it's in some denominations becoming another force for what is going on the left, which is just, you know, everything that's going on, cancel culture, trying to just hold up the weak for the sake of holding up the weak. Everything you said before, it's just becoming another version of sort of social justice. And one of the things he said was that everybody he knows that is turning to Christianity is turning to Catholicism, the Catholic Church, because it's almost like they're going to the purest form, or like the most religious or the most historical. I mean, those things are up for argument, I understand, but it's like a very intense version of church. Yeah. And that's because they're going to it because it's completely different to culture. Do you think there's something we need to do about church which attracts that? Do we need to set up church in a way that means that it's so different to culture? Or is there value in having stuff that's familiar, so people go, this isn't a totally strange experience. I feel like I can even step through the door. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. And I totally get that. Especially because a more traditional Christian, like a Roman Catholic or an Eastern Orthodox, for instance, or a more traditional Anglican, they try to be ancient. And we try to be modern.
Yeah.
All right, why do we try to be modern? Well, we try to be understandable.
Yeah.
And that is good. And Paul was all things to all people so that some might be saved. So that's good. But he was also unapologetically weird. And I think we need to be unapologetically weird as well. So whatever your view on robes or incense or bishops or any of the above, you cannot wash your hands of the absolute necessity of being an ancient movement of love. And there's something about the oddness. There's something about this does not come from the Liberal Democrat Party. This does not come from modern sensibilities. This is an ancient way that has been walked for 2,000 years. And you're welcome to come in on this way. But you're coming in on our thing, and we are heading in this direction. And I often think of 1 Corinthians 14 in terms of getting the balance right between being understandable and being very different. Because Paul says, look, there will be inquirers, and there'll be outsiders, there'll be skeptics, there'll be other people who will come in. And so translate your tongues. That was the presenting issue in 1 Corinthians 14. And you can sort of update that and kind of say, be understandable to a modern outsider who comes into your church. But you are to be understandable to the degree that they come into our churches and they say, God is really among you. They fall down on their knees and worship God is really among you. And I think we're always falling off one side or other of the horse. And some people, they're all tongues and strangeness. And, you know, and there are people sort of falling down left, right and center. And nobody knows quite what's going on. Other people, and I think this is more our tribe, other people are just, let's make everything plain. Let's make everything very understandable. And I don't want to spook you out, guys. Let's not be spooky here. Everything is explained and everything is brought down to a kind of a lowest common denominator level. And so things are understood, but no one's falling down and worshipping God. So I think we should keep in mind that there are outsiders and they need they need to figure out on some level what's going on. But I think people like a Douglas Murray or people like a Jordan Peterson are kind of, when Peterson does his Genesis lectures, like, he's just diving deep. I mean, like, I think his Jungian interpretation of Genesis is way off at points. But what he doesn't do is boil everything down to a little three-point sermon. He's really inviting people into the strangeness and the oldness to this thing. And lo and behold, millions are watching. And his good friend Jonathan Peugeot has his Eastern Orthodox, you know, channel. He's an icon carver, and he's a massive YouTuber in this sphere, and people are and he goes deep into the scriptures. And again, I don't agree with all his interpretations and things, but people are hungry for something different, and we always want to give people something modern. Maybe we should try and give people something ancient.
Yeah, fascinating. Okay,
I could deep dive into that, but I won't. But
that's the thing. I asked a question that we could talk about for about 3 hours. That's the problem.
But you asked an Anglican as well. You asked an Anglican, so
I know.
Apologies for that kind of an answer.
No, it's great. So to finish, I just want to get your opinion to help ordinary believers. The world feels like it's going at a million miles an hour with COVID. Things are changing all the time. And we've been through a kind of 2 year really weird zone of COVID and being inside and then being released and then all sorts. Do you think it's changed the landscape in any particular way in terms of how we evangelize to other people?
Yeah, I mean, everything has changed in one sense. And just everybody is tired. Everybody is exhausted. I'm on my fourth cold in about 3 weeks, and you know, in the office here, there hasn't been a day, I think, since September when we've had a full complement of people because of COVID quarantines or actual sickness, and everybody's tired, everybody's tetchy, and I'm always reminded of Matt, you know, the Telegraph cartoonist. A few years ago, he had this cartoon of it was like a street preacher, but his placard said, "Everything might be okay." And there's just a scene of this couple who are walking past the street preacher saying, "Everything might be okay," and they mutter to one another, "What a nutter." It struck me that being a person of hope is actually really countercultural right now. Having a sense of buoyancy, having a sense of peace, having a sense of rest, and having a sense of a future that I know is going to be okay. I think there's something weird to aim for. Not that you say, like Old Testament prophets, you know, peace, peace when there is no peace. But if you can model peace, if you can model, I'm genuinely a person of hope right now. I think that has the ability to make people sit up and notice. That was my short answer.
Yeah. If I could just throw another couple of things in just that might help people think. These are not original to me. I stole them from someone else. But I think COVID has taught us that we're not in control, which I think is an interesting way in with people, and that modern sophisticated societies are not in control. I think it's taught us that we're mortal, which is always a good lesson to learn. And I think it's taught us that we probably love community more than we thought we did. You know, we love sociability and community. So I think there are little ways in to do with that. Maybe that's just because I'm a preacher and, you know, chat with people as ways in. But I think in normal conversations, there's ways in with people thinking about what did we miss during COVID? What do we fear now more than we did before? What do we think about sophisticated industrialized societies? Well, we kind of think they get some things right, but they're actually quite fragile as well. That's kind of a way in to talk, I think, maybe.
Those are all great, great topics, definitely.
Cool. Yeah. Well, yeah, Glenn, thanks for joining us. It's been a really, really interesting conversation. I feel like everything we've talked about could have been a different episode of 3 hours long. But before we finish, just tell us, how can people find you? When's your book out? That kind of thing. Can you just fill us in on that?
The book will be out Easter 2022, called The Air We Breathe. It's with the Good Book Company, but it'll be available where all good books are sold. You can catch me on the website of Speak Life, speaklife.org.uk, or you can follow me on Twitter at Glenn Scrivener, just Glenn with one N.
Amazing. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Ordinary. We hope you enjoyed it.